Welcome to Bloomberg Law for this Wednesday, April 20th. I'm June Grosso with Michael Best. The Supreme Court rules that American victims of terrorism can collect $2 billion from Iran's central bank. It's a victory for the victims and for Congress, which passed a law aimed at helping them win the case. The Supreme Court ruled in favor of victims of terrorism and their families, clearing the way for them to collect nearly $2 billion from the Central Bank of Iran. The court decided Congress had not exceeded its authority when it passed a law in 2012 that specifically directs that bank assets in the U.S. be turned over to the families of victims of Iranian-sponsored terrorism. The vote was 6-2, with an unusual combination of justices dissenting, conservative Chief Justice John Roberts and liberal Justice Sonia Sotomayor.
Joining us today to talk about the court's decision are constitutional law scholar Stephen Vladeck, a professor at American University Washington College of Law, and Jimmy Garoulet, professor at the University of Notre Dame Law School and an expert on the law in terrorism and terrorist financing, who also filed an amicus brief in the case at the Supreme Court. Stephen and Jimmy, welcome to the program. We're very happy to have you here today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Stephen, let's start with the statute that was at issue here. What exactly did this statute do?
Sure. So, you know, as Jimmy can certainly speak more about, these plaintiffs had already obtained judgments against the Iranian National Bank arising out of Iran's role in funding acts of terrorism. And the question was, how could these plaintiffs execute on the judgments? Iran has a lot of assets in the United States. Those assets had actually been blocked by a series of orders from successive presidents of different administrations, so that even though these funds were here and even though these plaintiffs had a judgment, they couldn't execute on the judgment. And what Congress said in the statute was, in these specific cases and these cases only, the particular funds at issue could be used to enforce the judgment, notwithstanding the president's blocking orders. And the question that raised was whether Congress is allowed to basically create such a good for this case only kind of rule. Today, the Supreme Court, by a 6-2 vote, said yes.
Jimmy, explain the Supreme Court's reasoning in the majority.
Well, they advanced two important reasons. You know, first, they stated that changing the law with respect to a pending case and then affecting that law, or making it retroactive to affect and perhaps even change or influence the outcome in a pending case, did not violate the doctrine of separation of powers. And in an opinion written by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she cited to a number of prior Supreme Court cases that had supported that proposition. And then second, the court stated that when the political branches, Congress and the president, work together in coordination in the field of foreign affairs, especially with respect to national security and combating international terrorism, that the Constitution affords the political branches plenary powers, broad authority, and generally the court should be deferential to the political branches in this field. And the court concluded, held that that's exactly what this legislation involved. It involved the president and the executive working together on the field of foreign affairs, and the political powers, the political branches, had constitutional authority to do exactly what they did in this case.
But Stephen, many, many years ago, hadn't the Supreme Court held that Congress can't pass a law setting the decision rule for a particular case?
Indeed. I mean, so a lot of today's opinion and a lot of the jousting between Justice Ginsburg's majority opinion and Chief Justice Roberts' dissent were about the meaning of this Delphic 1872 decision called United States versus Klein. I think everyone agrees that at a minimum, Klein stands for the proposition that Congress cannot literally pass a statute that says in Doe versus Smith, courts, you must rule for Doe. The question is, how much further does the Klein rule go? And I think there were pretty strong arguments made by the Iranian bank and by Chief Justice Roberts in his dissent that that rule has to go a lot further than just the formal limit on Congress. That Congress can't effectively accomplish the same thing by saying, in this case only, courts, here's an outcome determinative rule that you must follow. The majority didn't buy it. The majority said this case is different enough from Klein because the statute at issue does not literally say, dear courts, you must rule for the plaintiffs in this lawsuit.
The Supreme Court ruled today that American victims of terrorism can collect $2 billion from Iran's central bank. It's a victory for the victims and for Congress, which passed a law aimed at helping them win this specific case. And the vote was 6-2, with an unusual combination of justices dissenting. Conservative Chief Justice John Roberts wrote the dissent, joined by liberal Justice Sonia Sotomayor. We've been talking with Professor Stephen Vladeck of the American University Washington College of Law and Professor Jimmy Gourlay of Notre Dame Law School. Stephen, the Chief Justice wrote that hereafter, with this court's seal of approval, Congress can unabashedly pick the winners and losers in particular pending cases. Is he right? Is there any clear line to block Congress from dictating results in ongoing cases?
I mean, June, I think the clear line that's still left after today's ruling is that Congress can't do that expressly. So I think, you know, even the majority would have trouble with a statute that said, you know, in June versus Michael, the court should and must rule for Michael. I think the harder question that the majority opinion raises and doesn't answer is what else can't Congress do after today? Can Congress say, here are a particular class of cases where we want this unique rule to apply and only in these cases? That's kind of what happened here. Can Congress say, in this particular class of cases, the law shall be X as opposed to and court shall do Y? So, you know, I don't think that the chief is right that today's decision overrules Klein, that today's decision says Congress can get away with anything. But, June, the real question is, you know, can Congress get away with anything short of literally saying, dear courts, you should and you will rule for this party? If the answer is yes, I'm not sure what that looks like.
Jimmy, you wrote an amicus brief on behalf of the families who are suing Iran in this case. How much do you think that the court's willingness to accept a law like this had to do with the fact that obviously these families are very sympathetic plaintiffs against a country that's been, you know, killed their family members in, by sponsoring terrorism?
Well, I think it may be a fact. The reality is the victims certainly are sympathetic. The defendant in this case, the Islamic Republic of Iran, is not. Further, Bank Markazi, the central bank of Iran, is not sympathetic, and that often happens in cases. I mean, certain parties are sympathetic, and others are not. But I think at the same time, following up on Steve's point, the particular statute that Congress passed here had a limited effect. It didn't say that the court should decide in favor of the plaintiffs. It didn't say that the court should decide against Bank Markazi or should order a certain amount of damages against and on behalf of the plaintiffs. Instead, it said that certain assets that belong to Iran that are held by a U.S. bank in the United States may be available, are available to enforce a terrorism judgment against Iran if the court finds that the assets belong to Iran and that there's no third party that has a legitimate claim to those assets. And so this particular piece of legislation really came in on the back end of the litigation, because by that time, the case has already been decided. The judgment had already been rendered against Iran. That had nothing to do with this piece of legislation. The court had further determined that the compensatory damages against Iran should be around $2 billion. That had nothing to do with this legislation. The question was simply, how is that judgment going to be enforced? And there were blocked assets that the United States had blocked in a bank account in New York. And the legislation said those assets shall be available to enforce the terrorism judgment against Iran. So it has limited application.
Steve, as Michael and I were talking about, Chief Justice Roberts cares about the court as an institution, perhaps more than any of the other justices. It is called the Roberts Court forever in history. So it's no surprise that he wrote the dissent. But what about the liberal justice, Sonia Sotomayor, joining his dissent? Is that a surprise?
It's a bit of a surprise, although I think, you know, Justice Sotomayor at the oral argument, I think, sort of tipped her hand and suggested that she, too, was skeptical of the statute. Again, not because I think she has any great sympathy for the Iranian National Bank or holds anything against these plaintiffs who have, you know, suffered, you know, the undescribable. Rather, I think it's because she joins Chief Justice Roberts in her concerns, not just about Congress in general, but about, you know, these recent Congresses in particular. And I think the concern is that once you allow Congress to pass statutes that are all about particular cases, are you in effect encouraging Congress to exercise the judicial power for itself and to actually, you know, legislate on a case-by-case basis what the rule should be? You know, it's not hard to think that Justice Sotomayor, who is a bit of a formalist, even if she's a liberal one, you know, would see in that a very dangerous future and one where an especially aggressive Congress could really test those limits to the court's detriment.
Jimmy, do you think that the dissenting justices are right, that this could be an invitation for Congress to start legislating on matters like this more frequently?
I don't think so. And again, I think we need to focus on the unique facts of the case. And as I just previously stated, the particular statute at issue here had very limited reach, had very limited scope. It certainly didn't go to the merits of the case. And I would further add that with respect to the procedural posture of this case, the federal district court in New York ruled against the bank, found no violation of separation of powers. A unanimous Second Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed that decision, found no violation of separation of powers. During the petition for certiorari, while the court was considering whether it was a grant review, the court on its own initiative asked the Department of Justice to submit an amicus brief on the specific issue of separation of powers and whether the Congress had intruded unconstitutionally on the role of the judiciary. DOJ submitted a brief, the Department of Justice submitted a brief, and it also agreed that there was no violation of separation of power. So all the way up the line, all the judges, the courts who were involved in this case found no violation of separation of powers. And at the end of the day, it was only two justices, Justice Roberts in dissent, joined by Justice Sotomayor, that had concerns, serious concerns about the statute at issue here. Six members of the majority did not.
Stephen, is there any danger of a misperception about the rule of law? In other words, if people look at this and say Congress can change the rules of pending lawsuits even as they're unfolding, what about plaintiffs and defendants who've spent time and money bringing or defending a lawsuit based on a certain theory of the case, and that theory has changed?
Yeah, I mean, Jude, I think that's a concern, but frankly, I think that's a concern that's already present. You know, the Supreme Court has been, to my disappointment, all too willing to let Congress change the rules of pending cases so long as Congress does so in a way that's of general applicability. And so I think, for example, there's a bill pending in Congress right now that would make it very much easier for the victims of 9/11 and their families to sue the Saudi government over its alleged role in funding the 9/11 attacks. That's the same idea. June, to me, the separation of powers issue here, which Jimmy scoffs at, is a little bit more serious, because it's not that Congress said in all pending and future cases, the rule going forward shall be thus. It's that Congress said in cases we are identifying by name and caption number, we are going to allow the parties to do something that no one else can do in any other case. And I think that's a much graver concern for the separation of powers going forward than Congress saying in all cases against foreign sovereigns, these will be the rules. In all cases against Iran, these will be the rules. For Congress to say in these cases specifically and these cases only, the rule is going to be different from the rule for everybody else doesn't sound like legislation to me. It sounds like Congress basically telling the courts how to do their job. Now, Jimmy's right. The courts had already ruled for the plaintiffs here, but the funds weren't available until Congress said, for you guys and you guys only, they are. And if Congress can do that, I just worry about what Congress could do going forward in other pending cases where it doesn't like what the courts have done.
I want to thank you both for being with us here on Bloomberg Law. Unfortunately, we've run out of time for today. That's Professor Stephen Vladeck of the American University. Washington College of Law, and Professor Jimmy Gourlay of Notre Dame Law School. Michael, let's take a look at the top story on BloombergLaw.com.
The Supreme Court upheld Arizona's state legislative districts today, rejecting contentions that the map unconstitutionally dilutes the influence of Republican voters. The high court said there was ample evidence that the commission was driven by partisan motivations, but by an effort to comply with the U.S. Voting Rights Act.
That's it for this edition of Bloomberg Law. We'll be back tomorrow and hope you'll join us as well. Thanks to our technical director, Reginald Bazile, and our producer, David Sucherman. With All Due Respect is next for our Washington, D.C. audience. Bloomberg Best is next for our listeners in New York, Boston, and San Francisco, right here on Bloomberg Radio. I'm June Grosso with Michael Best. Have a great evening and join us again tomorrow.